Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is your Calls One Planet series. Later in the show, we'll discuss the EPA's decision to approve the use of pesticides containing forever chemicals to be sprayed on our food. But first, we're discussing a new investigation by the New York Times' Peter Goodman and The Examination's Will Fitzgibbon called Recycling Lead for U.S. Car Batteries is Poisoning People. They write, "This is what the auto industry wants people to see. Sparkling factories turning reclaimed lead into batteries for Ford, Toyota, GM, and the rest. But in Africa's lead recycling capital, reality looks very different. Factories are poisoning people. We know because we tested them." Here is a clip from the video piece, How the U.S. Auto Industry Fuels Lead Poisoning in Nigeria.
Just outside of Lagos, Nigeria, lies Ogijo, Ogun State, a community that has become the lead recycling capital of Africa. The factories here recover lead for car and battery companies in North America, Europe, and Asia. Residents breathe in black dust from the factories, which contain invisible lead particles that spread across Ogijo. The metal seeps into the body, damaging the nervous systems. Residents here worry about the impact of the facilities on their livelihood and describe non-stop coughing and sinus problems. But the toll hasn't been fully understood. Until now.
70 people living near and working in factories around the town of Ogijo near Lagos, Nigeria, volunteered to have their blood tested by the New York Times and The Examination. 7 out of 10 had harmful levels of lead. Every worker had been poisoned. More than half the children tested had levels that could cause lifelong brain damage. The investigation also found that despite decades of evidence on the toxic effects of battery recycling, companies opted not to act and blocked efforts to clean up the industry. Joining us to discuss this investigation is Peter Goodman, award-winning global economics correspondent for the New York Times. Peter Goodman is the author of 3 books, including Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World, and most recently, How the World Ran Out of Everything, Inside the Global Supply Chain. When Peter returned from his reporting trip to Nigeria, he had unrelenting headaches and elevated lead levels in his blood, a small indication of what the people who live near these factories endure every day. Hi, Peter. Thank you so much to you and your colleagues for this important investigation, and thanks so much for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me, Rose. It's great to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back, Peter. Why did you all decide to focus on lead recycling in Nigeria? How did you learn about this?
Well, I learned about it from The Examination. This was a subject I knew absolutely nothing about. And I was approached by The Examination, introduced to Will Fitzgibbon, who's a lead expert, who'd spent a fair bit of time elsewhere in Africa, mostly in East Africa, looking at lead poisoning resulting from recycling lead batteries there. This is really a global industry. And we could have gone multiple places. And he had mapped out a plan where he was going to have blood tests commissioned. That was, you know, a new thing. There were ethical considerations there, but it's really, you know, excellent way to identify the extent of the harm in this town in Nigeria. And I said, well, what do I bring to this in terms of, you know, partnering? He said, well, the supply chain, I don't know anything about the battery supply chain, but, you know, as you noted in your intro, I'd written this book about the global supply chain. I've written versions of stories involving dirty, dangerous processes being shipped off to faraway places for the benefit of people in wealthy countries like our own. And Will said, look, we've got trade data showing that lead is coming out of these plants in Nigeria. It ends up in shipping containers, put on ships, and then it lands mostly at the port of Baltimore, and that's it. We don't know where it goes after that. We need somebody to help figure that part out. So that was my job in all of this.
Wow. So we'll give props to the Examination. This is an incredible news outlet investigating health threats and empowering communities. They cover tobacco, big food pollution, and more. You know, at a time when the media is really in a crisis, it's so important to highlight these incredible independent outlets like the Examination.
Absolutely. Yeah, they do remarkable work.
So let's just talk about the basics here. We're talking about the lead that is in batteries in millions of cars. You write, lead is an essential element in car batteries, but mining and processing it is expensive. So companies have turned to recycling as a cheaper, seemingly sustainable source of this hazardous material. And as the United States tightened regulations on lead processing to protect people in the U.S. over the past three decades, finding domestic lead became a challenge. And that's why the auto industry looked overseas to supplement their supply. Can you walk us through this?
Yeah, you bet. So it is true what the auto industry tells us, that lead is one of the most easily recycled metals on Earth. They give themselves kind of a halo for the recycling programs, and they deserve it in terms of their highest standard work in wealthy countries like the U.S., Canada, Europe, you know, places where people would not accept the trade-off of their health for a few more jobs, for a few additional, you know, bits of production. So we've had tightened environmental standards, and that has forced smelters to move out of places where they've run afoul of regulators. And eventually, we ran out of lead that could be harvested in North America. So, you know, a large battery manufacturer, we focus on one that I assume we'll get to, called East Penn, based in Pennsylvania. They have a program where they go buying up spent batteries. They bring them to their enormous facility in Pennsylvania. They extract the lead from the old batteries. They put that lead into these giant furnaces. They melt it down. They bring it to a level of purity where they can then use it to make new batteries. It's truly a closed loop, and they have to meet tight emission standards. They have to use automated equipment to break apart the batteries so they don't expose workers to the perils of being exposed to that lead. But they simply can't get enough lead to satisfy their needs within North America. So they've gone out around the world looking to supplement that supply. And Nigeria, you know, as I noted before, is just one of scores of countries, though it happens to be the one that's fastest growing as a source of exports headed to the U.S. But it's one of scores of countries that have stepped in to supply that lead that these battery manufacturers need.
You report that the town of Ogijo near Lagos, Nigeria, has more lead recycling factories than anywhere else in Africa. How did so many batteries end up there?
Well, look, Nigeria is a large country, right? I mean, you're talking about a couple hundred million people. It's one of the most important economies in Africa. So there are a lot of batteries there. We did hear stories that we never fully nailed down about batteries coming in from overseas. We do know that some are arriving with used cars that show up in the U.S., from the U.S. rather, to the market in Nigeria to be sold off there. But you know, you have this army of so-called pickers. These are people who roam around the countryside and cities in Nigeria, and they buy up spent batteries, and they bring them to these places known as breaking yards, where men, they are men, often shirtless, using machetes, minimal safety gear, break apart these old batteries. They take the plastic casing and they sell it off to recyclers. They spill the battery acid sometimes into waterways in the larger places. They'll put it in big tanks and sell it off for industrial purposes. And then they take the lead inside and they truck them up to these smelters in Ogijo. And originally there were smelters in Lagos itself. This is the largest city in Nigeria, but people complained. They didn't want particles and poison sifting through their midst. And so the smelters moved beyond Lagos and they moved into the neighboring state of Ogun, and they ended up in this town of Ogijo.
It was wild to also learn, Peter, and you just mentioned this, but the United States sends tens of thousands of secondhand cars to Nigeria every year.
Yeah, actually, a lot of them go out of a shipping terminal in Baltimore that's really close to the one where the recycled lead comes back in. We saw a line of cars waiting to be driven on to these big ships. This is where a lot of our old cars that no longer have value in the U.S., you know, it's totaled in an accident. You know, it's not worth a resale or a fix, but it's worth putting on a ship and sending across the water to Nigeria where somebody will make use of it.
Wow. You mentioned just how difficult this work is, and I hope everyone will take about 13 minutes to go watch the examinations video, how the U.S. automotive industry fuels lead poisoning in Nigeria. Peter, you have written just so many important stories about how the world is so connected now because of this global supply chain, and it's just so important for us to learn more about the people who are affected by whether it's consumption or in this case, lead recycling. And really, this is one of the few cases where it's one experience to read about it, but it's a completely different experience to see all of this in action, to see these men throwing these batteries from person to person and then slamming them and seeing all of this toxic stuff seep out of the batteries. It's just kind of rare to be able to watch something like this.
Yeah, it was shocking. I have to say, you know, I've been doing this a long time. I've been traveling around the world writing not just supply chain stories, but various business and economic stories in many parts of the world. I've never seen anything up close that shocked me to this extent. And I'd encourage you all, by the way, to take a look at Finbar O'Reilly's photographs. Our story is very photo-driven and for a good reason. Finbar is certainly one of the best photographers I've ever worked with, and he spent an awful lot of time in these breaking yards, really bringing home just how grueling this work is, how dangerous it is, and how unprotected these men are as they're going about their jobs.
Yeah, the photos are really incredible. And we'll read some of the captions of the people who have been affected by this. And another basic question, thinking about the supply chain, who in the United States is making the decision to allow this to happen?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, and it's important to note that like many supply chains, I mean, this part is kind of familiar to me. This one has so many different participants and involves so many different countries that it's almost engineered so that wherever you are in the chain, you can plausibly claim that, these horrible environmental conditions, this public health catastrophe, this is somebody else's responsibility. So, you know, it starts with the auto industry, which buys batteries from giant companies like East Penn Manufacturing, the one that we focused on. This is the second largest battery manufacturer in the United States. And, you know, they're focused on their domestic operations and on recycling as much as they possibly can inside North America, but they simply don't have enough. So they have to go buy some lead from elsewhere. And that's not their core expertise. So they call up these middlemen trading companies. One of them is Trafigura, a Swiss company that has kind of a checkered history. They were actually criminally convicted in Switzerland last year for paying millions of dollars in bribes in Angola as a way to get oil contracts. And they do a lot of work with various kinds of minerals and metals, and lead is one of their commodities. So East Penn goes and signs a contract with Trafigura, and they say, okay, we need this volume, we need to be this purity, needs to show up at our factory. They sign a contract, and then in according to our conversations with East Penn, when they eventually engaged with us, they said, well, you know, we took it on faith that traffickers' assurances that they do real due diligence, that they comply with social and environmental standards, that that was real. We didn't really pay much more attention to it than that. When we then confronted them with our own findings, told them about the blood test, told them about seeing the smoke and the dust staining people's laundry, landing everywhere, ingested by children as they play in the dirt. You know, eventually East Penn said, okay, we've told Trafficker not to send us any more lead from Nigeria. And then actually at that point we said, well, how are you making up the difference? They said, well, we're increasing our purchases from South Korea and Australia, two other suppliers of lead. And then we discovered in the trade data that South Korea receives lead recycled from Nigeria, from these same plants that we were looking at, and East Penn buys some batteries that are made in South Korea. So we said to the overseer of East Penn, this guy Chris Pruitt, hey, how do you know that you're not buying lead from Nigeria, recycled there and sent to South Korea? He said, well, it's a good question. It's really impossible to trace everything satisfactorily. And then, of course, we spent a lot of time looking at how Trafigura does due diligence at its plants in Nigeria and discovered that that was really performative at best. It's kind of an exercise of checking a box for liability purposes. They do. We actually spent some time with the consultants who do the inspections. We had dinner with one of them in Lagos one night, and he said, look, it's a real process. I go out to the factories and I note the problems, and then I'll give the smelters, these recycling plants, a list of suggested things that they should do to limit pollution. And, you know, we'll say, okay, you should hand out safety goggles to all your workers on a regular basis. You should do a better job of sweeping up the dust. And you should ideally add an automated system to break apart the batteries instead of relying on the guys with machinery. That last part will probably cost $3 or $4 million, will involve having to borrow that money at 15% interest or higher. And the factories will typically say, thank you very much for your suggestions. We will certainly do the first two, not sure about the third. And Trafigura says, okay, great, we're done. Keep sending us the lead.
You report that last year, Trafigura reported $243 billion in revenue by trading oil, gas, and metals worldwide.
Yeah, I mean, this is an enormous company, and their core competence is figuring out how to buy cheap and sell higher. And so I think it's fair to say that, you know, the auto industry is happy to outsource the dirty work of procuring lead to somebody else, and that's where Trafigura comes in. The buck really stops with them. And interestingly enough, that's the one company that really didn't engage with us. They just gave us a bunch of statements saying that they abide by upstanding, you know, standards.
On today's Your Call, we're joined by Peter Goodman, award-winning global economics correspondent for The New York Times. Peter and the Examination's Will Fitzgibbon have really important reporting out. Their investigation is called Recycling Lead for U.S. Car Batteries is Poisoning People. They found that 70 people living near and working in factories around the town of Ogijo near Lagos, Nigeria, volunteered to have their blood tested. 7 out of 10 had harmful levels of lead. Every worker had been poisoned. If you have any questions for Peter Goodman about this investigation, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's now talk about the human piece of this. And it's so important to emphasize, as you do in your report, that everything we're about to talk about is avoidable, because you write lead batteries can be recycled as cleanly as advertised. In Europe, experts say some recycling factories are spotless, but that requires millions of dollars in technology. So none of this has to happen, right, Peter?
That's right. I mean, these are decisions that we as human beings have made through the global economy about what matters. And we went through a long hypothetical exercise that we ended up abandoning, and I won't bore you with the reasons why. You know, how much more would it cost to for an American consumer to buy a battery that has lead that's entirely sourced from places that aren't poisoning people as part of that production. And, you know, we couldn't nail it down because all of these sources of lead end up being blended. There is no battery that's made just from lead that comes in from Nigeria. But I think it's fair to say that you're talking about, you know, pennies on the dollar at the end of the day. And so essentially, we as human beings, through the running of the global economy, have decided that the value of poisoning children in a school sitting next to a factory in Nigeria is minimal. It's a rounding error. This is, you know, absolutely a series of political and economic decisions. We can have our cars, we can have our batteries and the benefits of that modernity and still take steps that prevent people from being poisoned.
So when you returned from Nigeria, you had unrelenting headaches and elevated lead levels in your blood. Imagine what it's like for the people who live there. And this is how you describe it. Lead dust is everywhere, on kitchen floors, vegetable gardens, church grounds, and schoolyards. With every breath, local people absorb lead particles into their bloodstreams. The metal seeps into their brains, wreaking havoc on nervous systems. Toddlers ingest it by crawling across floors and then putting their hands in their mouths, in some cases leading to irreversible brain damage. This public health catastrophe is the result of local factories that recycle car batteries, extracting the lead within to make new products. So tell us more about this. What was it like to be there, to smell this, to feel all of this? What was it horrifying. That experience like?
I mean, it's horrifying. There aren't many places I've been in the world that kind of live up or exceed to the most extreme picture that you're conjuring for yourself inside your imagination. You know, typically you land in a place, even a place of conflict, even a place with horrible pollution. And, you know, on some level, life's going on. And don't get me wrong, life's going on in Ogijo too. I mean, people are raising their kids, they're growing food, they're going to their jobs. But everywhere you go, there are noxious clouds of smoke that are visible. I mean, I was brought into people's homes so they could show me, look, our walls are black. There's nothing we can do about this. A mother of three girls told me, when we mop, our feet are black. The soot is just constant. In a place where there's sweltering tropical heat, parents are shutting their windows at night because their kids are coughing. The mother of a three-year-old told me her daughter's constantly coughing and sometimes black particles are coming out of her mouth. So they're choosing to accept just being very uncomfortable in stifling hot air without air conditioning because they know that this poison is seeping in. And the story that kind of stays with me the most, my last trip there, which was just a few weeks ago, I was visiting with a bunch of families living in this row of single room houses, all connected right next to the True Metals smelter. That's the factory that we spend the most time on in the story. And there was a grandmother with this adorable girl. She was a five-year-old girl. I have a five-year-old at home. Actually, this girl was four. She was close to five. And, you know, I'm cognizant of the fact that, you know, in a wealthy country like the U.S. where we have all kinds of diversions, we have toys and playgrounds and iPads if we want, you know, it's tough to keep your kid out of harm's way. And here's this grandmother looking after her four-year-old who's playing in the dirt in front of their house directly next to this smelter. She's got a broken plastic spoon that she's using to dig through the dirt, filling up an empty plastic water bottle, her other toy. And then for an instant, she takes the spoon and she puts it in her mouth. And I said to her grandmother, not judgmentally, but really sympathetically, you know, do you worry about your granddaughter touching that dirt? And she said, absolutely. I mean, I'm doing the best I can. I said, do you have toys? She said, look, we have money for one meal a day. We don't have money for toys. And I've just been thinking about that ever since. And yeah, it's true. You know, I've come back not feeling great and I've had headaches and I had my blood tested, but I wouldn't crack any part of this story even for a minute. And I, of course, had the luxury to get on a plane and fly back to my home in New York. These are people with nowhere else to go, living right next to these horribly polluting facilities.
I think I'm looking at that grandmother right now, Peter, Tope Adebayo.
Yeah, exactly.
And her granddaughter, Darasimi, is 4 years old. And Tope says that when she plays outside in the dirt, I try to chase her away.
Right.
I mean, you can't. Kids love playing outside in the dirt. And yet, in this case, they're saying get away.
I mean, any parent. Understand. I mean, you could be at your high-end beach vacation and you're worried about your kid eating sand, but you have 27 ways to distract them and give them something more fun to do. I mean, to be living there with no resources next to a poisoning factory and you know it's in the dirt, I mean, it's just one of the most heartbreaking things I've ever seen.
Just a few other examples. I mean, these are beautiful photos. Mojireo Adadeo, yeah. 48. Everything is dark. The smoke is just too thick. Thomas Eade, 53. Doctors gave his son Freeman pills to reduce lead absorption. They told us the only preventative measure was to move away. And people said, we don't have money to do that. And then this one. Murray Corady, 50. He wants to protect his daughter, Sharon. If this were in other countries, they would not allow this. When you talked to them, Peter, what message did they want you to send back to the U.S.?
Well, you know, it's really that's the part of this reporting that's really tricky, right? I mean, I don't want to be like another white guy showing up in Africa promising to fix everybody's problems. People are certainly looking to me as like, well, you had the resources to get here. You must have some power and influence that we don't have. You know, please, you know, make them stop polluting. I mean, people don't want the factories closed. It requires a certain amount of sort of ruthless candor, or you're doing something unethical, to say, look, I feel for you guys. I'm here to tell your story. We definitely want to share this with the world, and hopefully there will be some change, but I'm not here to promise you some solutions that I'm in no position to deliver. Now, that said, I have been heartened to see that since our story ran, the Nigerian government and the state government in Ogun have come in and actually sealed off the 7 worst polluting plants. There's talk that actually, as we speak, they're conducting their own blood tests. The government's known about this since at least 2018. And so nobody should be declaring victory. Moreover, people in Ogijo generally don't want the plants to be closed because a lot of people work there. Mm. And let's face it, malnutrition is its own public health catastrophe. They want the plants cleaned up. But I think it's fair to say that it is hopeful that there's a new intensity of attention being focused on this. And I do hope that out of that will come some positive change for people living there.
And a few people are emailing saying, you know, why is the government allowing this? So you write in your piece, Nigerian officials are ill-equipped to monitor this. The government is battling an armed insurgency and endemic corruption and struggles to provide basic health services, even for urgent concerns like malaria. Power is dispersed among federal, state, and local authorities. Local monarchs hold ceremonial power. And then this was interesting to learn that in September, researchers who conducted the blood and soil testing concluded that most people with high blood levels had breathed in particles emitted by the factories. They wrote that the government needed to move quickly to address this. So that month, Nigerian officials closed 5 smelters, including True Metals. The authorities said the factories broke the law, but then days later, the factories were running again.
Yeah. So on my last trip, I actually went up to Abuja, which is the capital of Nigeria. And I visited I spent some time with the head of the enforcement division for the equivalent of the Environmental Protection Agency. And they told me that they said, look, we summoned the heads of those 5 factories up to Abuja. We told them that they are going to have to make changes that limit pollution. And they made a big deal out of telling me, you know, we got these signed protocols. They're committed, legally obligated to follow through. And I said, well, what's in the protocol? Well, there's a pledge that within 6 months, they have to implement automated battery braking machinery, among other things. So then after that meeting, some helpful person showed me a copy of one of the protocols. This was the one between the government and True Metals. And it didn't say anything about the 6 months. It didn't say anything about battery braking. There was a very generic promise that within 2 to 3 years, now think about that in the context of irreversible brain damage for kids living next to these plants. Within 2 to 3 years, they have to take some steps to improve their technology to limit pollution. Now, postscript to all this, in the last few days, hearing that the plants are again closed, I was able to reach somebody, let's just say, familiar with the process of enforcement, who said that the government was very disappointed with the lack of follow-through on those pledges and is now getting serious, and that's why they've once again shut down the plants. There was also reference in an announcement from the state, this is Ogun State, where Ogijo is located, yesterday, that this viral video had gone around. That was a video produced by The Times with my reporting partner, Will Fitzgibbon, of The Examination in it. You played a snippet of it earlier. And that because of that, they were shutting down the plants and administering widespread blood testing and holding a series of community meetings. So it seems like something new is happening, but we should be cautiously optimistic because certainly, and I heard this from officials directly in Abuja, the Nigerian government is cognizant of the fact that it has to balance development and the need for jobs against the mandate to limit pollution. And that sounds horrifying, and it is horrifying. And as we've discussed, those two things should not be in collision. But the reality is that when you shut down these plants, you are taking away people's paychecks. And so that's a balance that that has leaned, you know, heavily toward let's just keep business going at any cost. And there now seems to be a real attempt to bring that balance further toward public health. We'll have to see how that plays out.
And then last question about the automotive industry. Most car makers, including Ford, declined to comment on the findings. A few companies like Volkswagen and BMW promised to start internal reviews. Do you have any updates on that?
We don't. They've been silent. We've heard a lot of, you know, we've got your list of questions and we'll let you know when we have something to say. I mean, this is just simply not a part of the story that the auto industry would like us thinking about. They want us thinking about the green future in terms of electric vehicles. And by the way, most electric vehicles actually have a lead battery on board, a small one to power software systems in the background. So even if you're driving an EV, there's a decent chance that one of these batteries is sitting under the hood of your car. Mm-hmm. And they want us focused on the videos that we run at the top of our story on the New York Times, these, you know, glittering plants, mostly automated, really clean, latest generation pollution controls. That's what they'd like us thinking about, the circular economy, nothing wasted. And the part of this story that we are putting the spotlight on is just simply not the one they want us thinking about as consumers.
Hmm. Peter Goodman is award-winning global economics correspondent for The New York Times. He's the author of 3 books, including Davos Man, How the Billionaires Devoured the World, and most recently, How the World Ran Out of Everything Inside the Global Supply Chain. We interviewed Peter about those 2 books, and you can find those at KALW.org. Click news and your call. We've been talking about Peter's investigation with The Examination's Will Fitzgibbon, called Recycling Lead for U.S. Car Batteries is Poisoning People. Peter, huge thanks to you and your colleagues for this important investigation. Thank you so much for your work, and thank you for joining us.
Rose, thank you so much for putting so much attention on this story.
Thank you. And I hope you can take the time to read these investigations, spend some time with these really incredible photographs, and then you could also watch the video from the examination, how the U.S. automotive industry fuels lead poisoning in Nigeria. KALW.org, click news, and your call. Coming up after a break, we will talk about the EPA's decision to approve pesticides containing forever chemicals for use on our food. This is Your Calls One Planet series. We'll be back after this.